Did you try to remember? Because I'm.
Yeah, we can have one. Okay. Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this lovely February 3rd, 2016, and open a public hearing. Well, let me say first, in case you didn't hear me announce before, we will not be holding the informational hearing on DCBS and the question of MOTA. We're holding that over till probably Monday. Apparently the situation is very fluid and not really time to have a public discussion in the middle of a bunch of negotiations that are going on with us. So we'll hear about that anon or Monday, whichever comes first. Let me give you the order. I think we're going to hear the bills in. Again, if that makes a difference to you. We're going to start with House Bill 4095, go to House Bill 4124, then to House Bill 4106, and finish with House Bill
4105.
I'm sorry. And end with 4062. We'll probably break, as we do traditionally, for taking hearing from some of our colleagues, and maybe go slightly out of order, but basically in that order. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4095. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4095 requires the Oregon Board of Dentistry, upon the request of an individual who has been disciplined by the board, to remove from its website and any other publicly accessible print and electronic publications information relating to the discipline individual if the individual meets certain specified criteria, declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a no revenue impact on the bill and a minimal fiscal impact on the bill, Mr. Chair, and no amendments at this time.
So unless the testimony spoils it, we might actually move this bill.
Who would
be having? Yeah. We have support of it and no opposition, I understand. Who would be?
We have a neutral. We have, yes, one neutral individual and two supporting.
Okay. Sure. You've been fooling around with this long enough.
Yes, sir, we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Vic Gilliam, State Representative, Silverton. I'm very appreciative of you hearing this bill for the second time, Mr. Chair, and I'm appreciative especially to Vice Chair Representative Hayden, who lent his professional expertise to different aspects of this bill. There's no doubt, as I look at even the absent members, that your committee is committed to transparency in all levels of government. My question in the context of this bill is, when does that transparency sort of turn into an unjust punishment? My commitment to this bill stems from a personal story from a dentist. I will not repeat the story because you've all heard it in the spring of 2015. That story motivated me to bring this bill forward. A mistake was made. It harmed no patients. It was over a decade ago. The mistake was self-reported. All punishments, financial or otherwise, were met. No violations in over a decade. Yet, the material remains on publications, intentional or not. So, Mr. Chair, you offered ample time for discussions, and I understand there were some. If they went well, it was because I was not informed and I was not present. But I firmly
be careful about that.
Again,
We were careful about that.
Yeah, I knew you would. I firmly believe it's time for action, and I urge passage of this bill. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the witness? Madam Minister, would you call the panel? You want to hang in? That's fine.
Sure.
Georgia Kulik and Stephen Prisby.
Well, they're coming. I think as we move this, think about moving this bill, we have talked to all the boards as a part of the vice chair's activity. They all say that when they put something on, it's on permanently. I think as we think about this, we ought to think about the same kind of opportunity for other boards, because all we really do is give somebody an opportunity to ask the board to do something that's so reasonable. So we won't slow this up for that process, but that'll be on our mind. Who's next?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, Vice Chair Nosey, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Prisby. I'm from Portland, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Dentistry. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 4095. Our board has not met and discussed this, so I don't have an official position from the board, but I will share some comments and some notes based on what we've talked about in the past and what staff have looked at after reviewing the bill. And I won't read my whole testimony that I've submitted, but I'll summarize the points.
Appreciate that.
You're welcome. The OBD staff and I have noted that public record requests would still require us to disclose this information, even if it is redacted or removed from websites or electronic publications. The language in Section 2D references a licensee being in good standing. We need to define that better because it's not defined in the Dental Practice Act. Governor Kate Brown recently issued Executive Order Number 16-06, which addresses public record policies and will impact our agency to enhance more transparency and accessibility to Oregonians. Chair Greenlick, you referenced the 18 boards have met and discussed this about removing license information from websites, and we have met. We've obviously prepared a letter for you, and you've read that letter, and we're still working on that, and we're looking for more guidance. To comply with this bill will necessitate the OBD to reallocate resources of staff time and money, and I'm just concerned that it might make the OBD look like we're trying to protect certain licensees who have unflattering discipline action if other licensing boards are not doing it. The board only posts disciplinary information on our website when both the board has voted to discipline a licensee and the consent order has been signed by the licensee and the board president. Pursuant to ORS 676.175, complaints and investigations are not public records. I've discussed this legislation with the ODA and the ODHA, and we enjoy very good working relationships. And we appreciate the feedback they have on this legislation and other legislation impacting our dentists and dental hygienists. The board pledges to work with this committee and the parties involved to draft and craft legislation that is acceptable to all parties and continues to protect the public. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
George?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association, here very much in support of 4095. First off, I did want to thank Representative Gilliam and Representative Hayden and Representative Greenlick for the time you guys have put into this piece of legislation. It's obviously a bill that we have seen several sessions right now. It's an issue that continues to be much discussed amongst the members in the ODA. House Bill 4095 allows the licensees the ability to apply to the Board of Dentistry to have certain disciplinary actions removed for their websites. We do continue to understand that there are things that occur, that people do have minor disciplinary actions that don't involve financially or physically harming a patient, that we do believe that after a certain period of time, applicants and licensees should have the ability to come back and request that these be removed. I think one of the difficulties that we hear from our membership is often some of the issues that our folks do get disciplined from are sort of technical in nature, deal with record keeping or their continuing education credits or procedures that a lot of times just the general public doesn't understand. And so right now there is really no distinction between sort of these minor offenses and some major offenses. And so we look forward to the opportunity to basically allow folks after, you know, again, a certain period of time to be able to come forward and say, for some of these minor offenses that, again, do not harm somebody financially or physically, that they have that ability to be able to ask the board to remove it from their record. We did have a conversation yesterday with the Board of Dentistry. They did, in our opinion, bring up some good points about some changes that need to be made. Stephen mentioned a couple. There is really no definition right now of good standing in the Dental Practices Act, so that needs to be either eliminated or changed. Also, I know there was some discussion about them having the ability to get ready to do this, to be able to send this out to licensees and give them notice. And this bill right now does have an emergency clause, and our folks were open to the suggestion that if they needed a little bit longer to be able to notify licensees, you know, we could do that. Finally, the one other discussion, I apologize for my voice cracking, but one other issue that we did have some discussion around, and I think this was in an amendment from last session, is the deletion of Section 2 C, which basically allows is sort of that self-reporting requirement. There's another number of examples we have of a person who sends their continuing education credits to the board.
Thank you.
Only later to say that they had filed it 2 weeks later. Unfortunately, because of the fact that they had notified the board of that, it kind of prevents them from being able to qualify for this. So, like Stephen said, you know, we do have a few minor changes, but besides that, we're very supportive of the bill and would hope we can move it forward this session.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Comment?
Please.
Brief comment. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. My understanding of this bill and working with the bill is, and I want to rest assured that the public, that this bill doesn't affect the information being linked to the National Practitioners Data Bank, which is the information that entities go that hire a dentist when they want to look at a dentist's background. Is this dentist, he or she, a good fit for our organization if they're coming from another state or something? And so that does not affect that at all. What they're talking about here is a technicality that happened 10 years or more ago that doesn't flash up on a website for the rest of that practitioner's life. And so I want to make it clear to the record that as far as vetting background, that information continues to be available to keep the public safe.
We agree with that. And it's also available on public information from the board itself. It just takes it off the web page. It allows somebody to ask for it to be taken off the web page. If there are some perfections being perfected in the Senate, I think you've had it in the House long enough. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4095 and open a work session. Don't go yet, Representative. Open a work session on House Bill 4095. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, may I represent?
That's a representative. That's not kind of
what? What are we doing?
We get the honors.
Okay. Do you want to make a motion?
Yeah, I'll do it. Chair Greenlake, I move that House Bill 4095 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
President Hayden moves House Bill 4095 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? We're lacking one member. Oh, no, we're all here.
We're all here.
Excellent. Call and roll, please.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
yes.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Yes, with enthusiasm.
Oh, you gotta torture him a little bit. He's like he's. Oh,
this
sorry.
This is the second year he's bringing it back.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Aye.
And Chair Green.
Aye. Motion carries. Did Gilliam carry the bill?
Will you write my speech?
After you get to read the whole bill. Thank you for working with us, Representative Gilliam.
Wow.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4124.
Yes.
Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4124 requires the Oregon Health Authority to disclose prescription monitoring information to practitioner or pharmacist or member of a practitioner or pharmacist staff to use in certain health information technology systems. Mr. Chair, there's a no revenue impact on the bill. Well, what we have before us is a dash one amendment. And I do believe what...
You said there's no revenue?
On the dash one amendment, there's no revenue. On the dash one amendment, there is a fiscal impact statement that should be up on OLIS. Representative Bueller, did you?
You want to lead us off, Representative?
Sure, I'll be glad to. Yeah.
And if you don't mind, I'm going to call and see if Rep. Williamson is.
I think she wanted to be here also.
And I told her about 1:30, so let me see.
Do you want me to wait?
No, let's go.
Okay.
There is one or more amendment. I understand there are two amendments coming, and we'll hear about those as we go on.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and esteemed colleagues on the House Health Care Committee. My name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And this bill, House Bill 4124, really deals with a full-blown public health care crisis in this country. And it's not Ebola epidemic or even the Zika epidemic. It's a crisis of narcotic painkiller prescription abuse and increasingly heroin addiction, not only in this country, but also in this state. And it's increasingly personally devastating to people, not only in Oregon, but also at the community level. It's estimated by the Kaiser Family Foundation that 16% of all Americans know someone who's died from a prescription painkiller overdose, and 9% have even seen a family member die from these types of overdoses. It's causing heartache and loss in families and communities all over the state. Now, as a background, addictive narcotic painkillers once were reserved really just for extreme situations like treating terminal cancer. But this has changed practices over the years, and drugs like Vicodin and OxyContin are increasingly been used to treat chronic conditions like back pain and even arthritis. And this was really a change in prescription patterns back as far as 20 years ago. And it was driven by a couple things. It was driven by the pharmaceutical industry, at least a small section of it, combined with providers who bought into the notion that these narcotics would not become addictive. And there were some studies that were interpreted in the wrong way that said that people who were treated with opioids, narcotics, such as Vicodin and OxyContin, wouldn't get addicted, or at least a very small percentage, less than 1% of people would get addicted. There are people who thought that was wrong, but we are encouraged as a medical profession to prescribe these drugs. I remember when I was in practice, even this legislative body back in 2000 passed legislation to educate doctors in Oregon to prescribe more narcotics. I remember one of my senior neurosurgery partners who had treated young soldiers in Vietnam in the 70s, saying, this is so wrong. I saw people get addicted time and time again in Vietnam, and it's going to happen here. And he was so right. He was so right. And we see the devastating effects of this throughout the country. So it's clearly we have to solve this crisis. And this is not going to be an easy problem to solve, because it's multifactorial. And it's been exacerbated now by this incredible inflow of black tar heroin from Mexico, which is very cheap and very easy to obtain. And what we've created is a bunch of people who've got addicted to prescription drugs. And now as their need for these medications go up and their access becomes more difficult to obtain the prescriptions, they're turning to heroin, which puts them in a whole nother category of risk. And many times the people who are preyed on by the heroin dealers are in some of our most vulnerable communities. Communities that over the last 20 years in the state of Oregon have really been decimated from a variety of causes, and many times economic. So you have this confluence of factors which is causing an incredible devastation in our communities. So it's time to solve this crisis. This bill, admittedly, is a small first step forward, actually second step forward, because of some work has been done in the past. And it does so in two ways. One is it helps fix to what's called the prescription drug monitoring program, which is a way for providers to know where people are getting these narcotic prescriptions. The problem now is it's not being commonly used. It's just too hard to access. The data does not come into the usual workflow of a provider, and hopefully the changes we have here will make that data more accessible and easier to use. And the second thing this bill does is actually increases the access to naloxone, which is a medication which allows reversal of someone who's having an overdose of an opioid. Now, this medication is safe. In fact, it's if you give someone it inappropriately, it just doesn't work. It only works if someone has opioids on board and going through withdrawal or need rescue. And what this bill would do is push that closer to the user. And make it more accessible to loved ones who wants to go
sure
get the medication.
Pusher is the right.
Excuse me.
I said I'm not pushy, just talking about pushing. Is
that
the
terminology.
Right,
but, yeah. and also other places where you might see this need, such as drug treatment facilities, homeless shelters, and the like. So I very much would appreciate your support and be open to questions.
Senator Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jennifer Williamson, State Representative, House District 36. I have been in front of this committee before, telling the story that I'll tell now, and I think this time I won't cry. One of my first, as a representative, one of the first bills I testified on was our naloxone bill in 2013 that allowed lay people to be trained in administering naloxone. And at the time, I told you the story of my mom, who OD'd on prescription pain medication. Her pharmacy changed her pain medication from taking two pills to taking one that was double the dose. And she took two, like she had after her surgery, and ended up in an overdose situation. And she went to the hospital. My dad was there with her. So we were really lucky. But there's, you know, we were just lucky. Lots of families have dealt with this sort of situation and have not been so lucky. And so the tool of naloxone or Narcan in that sort of situation would have been a tool that my dad could have administered had things gone really horribly wrong with my mom. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, that I was late, so I don't know if I'm repeating some statistics here. I don't know if you got into Okay. So Representative Buehler talked about kind of the path to which people become heroin addicts and why it's such a crisis in our country right now. And every day in the United States, 44 people die as a result of prescription opioid overdose. And between 2013 and 14, the death rate for most commonly prescribed opiate pain relievers increased by 9%. The death rate from heroin increased by 26%. But if you include synthetic opioids, It increased by 80%. So clearly, we're on. This is becoming more and more of a crisis, and you know, Oregon is not immune from this crisis. 522 people died from opiate overdoses in 2014 alone in Oregon, a 13% increase from the year before. On average, 3 Oregonians die every week from a prescription opiate overdose. And heroin-related deaths in Multnomah County dropped from 101 in 2013 to 72 deaths in 2014 after we implemented the bill that we passed to extend and expand the use of naloxone in our communities. And, you know, we talk a lot about money in this building, and this bill actually would save Oregon taxpayer money. The Oregon Medical Association reports the cost between $20 and $40 for a full Narcan kit, but an overdose costs taxpayers approximately $30,000. So we can see that from a human perspective, a family perspective, and a bottom line dollar perspective, access to Narcan, the more access we can provide, the better it is for our state. Thank you.
We have in our possession now a -2 amendment. That's your amendment, this bill. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, in front of you, you have a -2 amendment. You may recall last session we passed a bill to allow pharmacists prescribing for the patch and the pill for birth control. And the -2 amendment is pretty straightforward. It adds Depo-Provera and the NuvaRing to those birth control options that pharmacists can prescribe. This is the law in California, and Washington is considering a bill to do the same thing right now. So my hope is to increase access to birth control so that women have the ability to choose the form of birth control that works best for them.
Can I ask a question? Thank you very much. Really compelling testimony, very important bill. I have a question on the amendment related to that, and it's on page 8, line 24, where it removes the word patch for contraceptive patch and replaces it with injection. Are we taking away anything while we're adding? Because there's not an and.
No. I just got this.
Okay.
But as I understand it, the term hormonal...
injection?
Yeah. Because it's an injection that the pharmacist would have to give you as opposed to being self-administered,
yeah.
That's why that language was changed.
So I just want to make sure we're not
nope.
precluding patches.
No.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have two panels, I think.
Yes.
Can I call the first?
Sure. Dr. Katrina Hedberg, Dr. Mike Henstrom, Dr. Paul Lewis.
Try and be concise.
I still don't like it that. This is the first time I've seen either.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, and Vice Chair Haley, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the State Health Officer with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to testify on House Bill 4124, which really does two things. One is to allow access to the prescription drug monitoring system through an HIT system, and the second has to do with naloxone. So as already has been described, basically opioid overdose is a national epidemic, and it is here in Oregon as well. It encompasses not only prescription opioids, but then there are a number of people who use both that as well as illicit opioids, and in addition, heroin, which, of course, is an illegal drug. So there's a variety of interventions that need to happen, everything from too many medications out there that may get people started to use, to saving folks from overdose through naloxone, to also access to medication-assisted treatment for people who are addicted. So this bill really addresses a couple of those things. As has been mentioned before, the prescription drug monitoring program is something that we have in the Public Health Division, which allows providers to access it in order to get information information about prescriptions that they're of scheduled substances that their patients have gotten. However, and it will be testified in a minute, that that doesn't always fit very well in the workflow, for example, in an emergency department. So this particular bill does not allow new users for the PDMP, but rather for already authorized users to access the PDMP through existing workflow and in the hospital emergency department system. There's been a fair amount of work that's been done on this bill prior to this to ensure things like privacy and security and a number of the concerns that folks had had about the prescription drug monitoring program, and I think we, the bill now addresses most of those concerns.
You put a fiscal on it and an FTE to do that piece, is that?
So there is a Chair Greenlick, so you're referring to the fiscal impact for this. There is a fiscal impact and that I think has just been given, and there's a couple of ways around. So, yes, we would need a staff person within the Public Health Division eventually. It depends on which biennium. But a lot of the system would be developed outside the Public Health Division. So we have a vendor that that does the PDMP, and it's similar to vendors that other states are using as well. So we would really try to do this in the most efficient way possible.
I would just point out that with that fiscal, unless we do something to change it, this would go to Ways and Means, you know.
So, Chair Greenlick.
Things go to Ways and Means. They don't always come out.
So, thank you. Yes, it does have a fiscal impact. So, and the second aspect of the bill does allow for naloxone. Again, this is a life-saving medication. Currently, pharmacies, of course, dispense naloxone. This would allow pharmacists to both prescribe as well as dispense naloxone. After some training, and we have developed a training, as was alluded to a minute ago, that is available, again, for family members primarily or other close folks with somebody who is either using these prescription or potentially heroin to have this available as a life-saving medication. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Mike Henstrom, and I come from the Portland area representing the OMA and the Oregon chapter for the American College of Emergency Physicians. As a introduction in support of House Bill 4124, I'd like to say that I also hope to represent the patients and people of Oregon, because ultimately that's what this bill is here for, is for their safety. And as well said by Representative Williamson in her story, that's one of many that we see on a daily basis. And hopefully that we can look at these patients that we see as patients that we can help overcome these addiction problems and identify early in this course and provide resources that will get them back in a meaningful situation. And as already elaborated, this will do two things. It'll streamline the effectiveness in our workflow. Currently, we're using an emergency department information exchange, and having the PDMP, the drug monitoring program, integrated into our information exchange makes it there right available as soon as we're clicking on the patient's chart. It's a very cumbersome system right now, logging into the PDMP, to the point that it's caused many of my colleagues to be frustrated, to the point that, not to mention, I think I'm 6 or 7 exclamation points onto my password. This is certainly a way that'll get more members using that in a meaningful situation. I had the opportunity, I just came straight actually from our annual conference in Central Oregon for the emergency physicians in Oregon, and was able to meet with some national representatives there. Dr. Girardi, who's the immediate past president for ACEP, which is about 31,000 board-certified emergency physicians in the country, and he mentioned that they're on a national level meeting with the DEA and other national leaders to work on solutions to this problem. One of those key things is making the PDMP more available, and they came to Oregon, they're going to Washington, they're looking to our states as leaders in this effort, as we're far ahead of the curve with our information exchange, and this bill will only help us in that effort to show how beneficial this can be for our patients. I know that the second part of this solution is the availability of naloxone, and I know Dr. Lewis will share more on this, but I've seen its effectiveness in those that have been prescribed. A young 20-year-old female in the last few months I saw whose family had it available to them in an overdose situation of heroin and saved her life. Who knows how long it would have been for medics to get there if she would have suffered anoxic brain injury before they could have administered it to her. So certainly it and can have that benefit. And I'd like to end with my appreciation for your time. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you.
Great. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name's Paul Lewis. I'm a practicing pediatrician, and I also serve as the Multnomah County and Tri-County Health Officer for Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington Counties. Today, I was also asked to speak for the Association of Oregon Counties, the Coalition of Local Health Officials, and the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, as well as the health officers for Jackson, Josephine, Hood River, and Umatilla counties. I'm mostly here to thank you. I've appeared before this committee, both in session and out of session, to support your insightful and compassionate efforts to decrease deaths in our state as we suffer, as the rest of the country does, from opiate misuse and dependence. You understand that there is an antidote for potentially fatal overdoses. Overdoses of opiates are so profound that people not only lose consciousness, but they even lose the ability to do the most basic of human functions, which is breathing. Not breathing quickly leads to death. Naloxone has been called the Lazarus drug because of its remarkable ability to immediately reverse the effects of an opiate overdose. It can be given very easily without any medical training by a simple injection into muscle, or what we mostly recommend is just by squirting it up somebody's nose. That's all that needs to be done, and that's the method typically chosen by our law enforcement colleagues. In 2013, you passed legislation that made it legal for lay people to administer this prescription drug to suspected overdose victims. The year that it went into effect, the first full year in Multnomah County, we had a 30% decrease in fatal overdoses. I challenge anyone to find another legislative action that has such an immediate and profound effect on health. Nationally, however, opiate overdoses continued to increase. So we were an outlier because of the decrease, and it was directly attributable, in my opinion, to the 2013 legislation. Despite this, we still have at least two overdose deaths a week in Multnomah County, and more than a dozen EMS responses for overdoses. More needs to be done at the front end to prevent dependence and addiction, but this intervention to prevent deaths is critically important as well. As Jennifer Williamson mentioned, in 2015, we had the Good Samaritan legislation. We appeared between sessions, and you wanted to know how are we going to get it publicized. We have pocket cards that we're giving out through our outreach workers and to people using injected drugs that says to tell them about this law so they will call 911 and help save more lives. The thing I want to mention, and I know that you understand, is that opiate addiction is not a moral failing. Everyone is vulnerable to this based on our human biology and our brain receptors. Many people in this room have either observed or been affected directly by these problems. Even the truly innocent, my patients' children, become dependent on opioids when they're treated for a long period for painful conditions such as multiple trauma or cancer. And everyone suffering from such dependence needs help to gain recovery. But recovery is not possible if someone has a fatal overdose. So obviously I'm in support of this bill, and I ask that you help continue the path that you started to do this. As you know, it makes it easier to provide access without needing to visit a physician or a nurse practitioner. And it follows the pattern mentioned before to allow access to more medications through pharmacists. According to the Network for Public Health Law, 27 states already have some sort of statute that allows greater access to naloxone, and two other states have implied authority in statute. I also want to point out this is not just a Portland Metro issue. The state has demonstrated there are many areas of the state, all areas affected by this problem. And this particular bill, where there are not extensive community programs such as we have in the metro area, will definitely increase the access to naloxone throughout the state and not just in the metro area. So again, I thank you for your ongoing multiple-year attention to this problem. The friends and families saved by this simple intervention are grateful to your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Call the next panel, please. I appreciate you guys coming down.
Thank you.
Josh Freed, Nikki Terziaf, and Kimberly McCullough.
Try and be brief, please. I know it's hard for some of you.
Well, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Nikki Terziaf here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. It's a coalition that represents both Main Street pharmacists as well as pharmacies that are based in the health systems and hospitals. We are here in support of this bill. We're absolutely pleased that you've brought it forward, Representative Bueller. Thank you. We're glad because it's two reasons. One, not the least of which, is that it's for the health and safety and well-being of Oregonians, but also because it's a great build upon clinical pharmacy services and some of the advanced that we're making to keep pharmacists practicing at the top of their license. And to talk a little bit more about that is Josh Free from the Coalition.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Appreciate you hearing our thoughts on this. Short of repeating the many excellent points that have already been made, I will just say that, as Nikki said, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association is in support of this. And the electronic integrations piece, I would say, may sound like minutia, but I can personally attest that if the information that's contained in PDMP is not easily available, it does not get used as effectively as it could be. So, with regard to naloxone prescribing, again, the points that have already been made, I'm in agreement with, and I would just add that pharmacists being a part of that accessibility to naloxone, we feel that pharmacists can do this effectively and safely, and there are a number of parallels to the birth control legislation from last year, and so there's some similarities there, and we believe that pharmacists can be an integral part of this and help increase that accessibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Kimberly, thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'd like to start at the outset by saying that we did originally have some privacy concerns about the pharmacy database portion of this bill when the concept first came up. And at the same time, we couldn't just disagree that the policy behind it was good and, you know, that is improved patient care. And so because of that, we worked with the proponents to improve the bill and to address the concerns that we had. And I'd just like to say that I am very, very appreciative that the proponents were very willing to work with us and did listen to us and also worked with the privacy expert who's on the PDMP commission, who we have a great deal of respect for, to make sure that things were going to be sufficiently privacy protective. One of the final issues that we had brought up is addressed by the Dash One amendment. And so long as that amendment is adopted, then the ACLU is officially neutral on this bill. I submitted a document to OLIS that you all can look at. It has there's a lot of technicalities here, and so if you want more information, you can look at what I submitted. But I'll just run through really quickly the concerns that we had and how they were addressed. The first thing that we were concerned about was making sure that this wouldn't open up this data to be more accessible by law enforcement. When the PDMP was created, there were a lot of concerns about, is this going to be a law enforcement tool? Is this going to be something that law enforcement can get access to? And so there's very specific requirements that law enforcement needs to have a warrant before they can obtain this data. And as the bill is written, it doesn't change that at all. So even though this information is now going to be accessible through these other health information exchanges, it won't change law enforcement's ability to get that. They'll still need to get a warrant to get that data. The other thing we were concerned about is these other health information systems are not always as privacy protective as they ought to be. And the PDMP has a lot of privacy protections that have been incorporated into it. And so we are concerned that if this information is available in this other system and the other systems are not as privacy protective, that could be, it could put that data at risk. The Dash One amendment in particular really addresses that. And what it does is it requires the Oregon Health Authority to essentially to look at these other systems ahead of of time, make sure that they're compliant with HIPAA, make sure that they're compliant with whatever rules OHA comes up with, and then periodically check back and make sure that these other systems are continuing to be compliant with those privacy rules. Another concern that we had was just making sure that people who are accessing these other systems have the proper authentication, that they're authenticated as proper users, because some users of these other systems may not have access to PDMP. They might be not be authorized users. And so, again, we worked with the proponents to make sure that that's really clear, that that can't happen. For the emergency room systems, my understanding is that everyone in the emergency room will actually be an authorized PDMP user. So because of that, then when they have that emergency room system, the same people who can access it are already people who can get into the PDMP. And then for the other health information systems, there's going to be an authentication that happens at their login. So when they log into that system, it will verify that they're a PDMP user, and they'll only get access to that data if that happens. And then there's a couple more just sort of more technical issues that I don't think you guys need to hear about. You can look at my testimony if you'd like, but I just want to say that we are very happy that this was able to be something that we could work out, and we look forward to participating in the rulemaking process as it proceeds.
Thank you. I'm happy to be worked out too. Okay, thank you all very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4124. We'll schedule a work session, I think, for Monday, and get the amendments. We'll have two amendments to deal with. Have to deal with the fiscal. If we can do anything to modify that fiscal, it might not be a bad idea. I don't know whether Public Health Division is still with us, but think about that. And I will thank you for all of your work. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 4105. Is that right?
That is right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4105 requires a pharmacy or pharmacist that dispenses biological products to report certain information electronically or to the prescribing practitioner, provides exceptions, declares an emergency effective on passage. You should have on OLUS or in your packet a -1 amendment that the good representative Nose will walk us through.
Do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, I think what would make the most sense, just for purposes of efficiency, is if we let the witnesses and the proponents come up and explain the bill and speak to the amendment. I mean, I'll just be, you know, candid with the whole committee. You know, this has been a labor of love, compromise bill, and I would just let them kind of come up and walk us through it. And I think we've got something that most of the parties that have been involved with this could live with. And as they walk you through it, they'll explain.
You're still here as a labor of love.
Sure.
You call the first panel, please.
Sure.
Do you have a preference, Representative?
Let's see.
See who you want.
I would invite first up Paul Cosgrove, Jessica Adamson, and Luis Rodriguez, and then Courtney Dresser. That'd be like the first program. That's four, I realize, but
that's okay. Well, when one finishes, you can switch chairs.
I can kneel.
I think you're okay, Paul.
It's not that bad.
Sorry, let's go.
Let Paul start.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, Paul Cosgrove representing Amgen. Amgen is a pharmaceutical company that makes biologics, both the innovator products, which some people all brand products, plus we make biosimilars. Our first one was submitted to FDA just a couple of weeks ago, and we have 7 or 8 in the pipeline. So we have an interest in making sure that these products are used, that the market of prescribers has confidence in using these products, and that they're used in a way that the information flow gets back to the people who need to have that in a way that's the most efficient way for all the parties involved. So House Bill 4105 is here because the bill that passed in 2013 had a sunset on one provision, and that provision was the notification back to the prescriber
when a substitution of a biological product was made by what is commonly called a biosimilar, which is not exactly the same as a generic, because biological products are never exactly the same, even when they're close. And that's the chemical difference, the biological difference for why they're handled somewhat differently. So that provision sunsetted actually just earlier this year, and we're back to have you consider House Bill 4105. The bill deals with that provision and also with a couple of others, and I'll just walk through what they are, and I'll be referring to the Dash 1 amendment, which I hope is up on OLIS, because the Dash 1 amendment makes some changes to the bill, some of them minor but important to various members of the greater body of people that we were discussing.
My intention is to open up a work session just to put the Dash 1s on for today. So, yes, refer to the Dash 1s.
Dash 1s, thank you. I will thank you. So, first of all, the Dash 1s compared to the bill in the prescriber notification, the bill says that will happen in 5 calendar days, and we changed that at the request of some parties to 5 business days. But in any case, it will happen. But the more important thing is, and this has been negotiated amongst these various kinds of parties you're seeing here nationally, and we will, if we do this, be the 19th state to do it. It just passed one of the bodies of one of the states yesterday by a vote of 158-1. So we're hoping that this compromise can be widely accepted. We've worked on it long enough that we hope it has. When you prescribe a product and the person has third-party coverage of any kind, Medicare, Medicaid, commercial insurance, at a community pharmacy, whether it be a chain drugstore or an independent drugstore, we've all seen this. The pharmacy or the pharmacy tech or the staff in the pharmacy pushes a button to say, is this a covered medication under your plan? What that does is send the information about the particular drug, its manufacturer and its name and all of those details to usually a pharmacy benefit manager who comes back and says yes or no, it is covered or not covered, and how much the copay is. That becomes the notification in this bill back to the physicians, because physicians, that information goes into another system which physicians have access to. Do all physicians access that information? No. Can they all access that information? Yes. There are other methods that are also in the bill for the notification to get back to the folks. If it's entered into one of the electronic medical records that many systems either have or are in the process of creating that cross over not only their hospitals, if it's a hospital-based system, but their community physicians, their hospital physicians, their own pharmacies, their labs. Some of those systems are moving pretty quickly, and we hope they will continue to move to electronic medical records. Entry into a commonly held electronic medical records also satisfies the prescription, the notification communication back to the provider. So those provisions are all here, and in the amendment, they are all actually, they're in the base bill, those provisions, with minor changes in the amendment. We also talk to people to try to address that these drugs are also dispensed in places other than a community pharmacy. They're dispensed in the hospital to a patient who is hospitalized. They are sometimes mail-ordered from a specialty pharmacy and dispensed or administered by a nurse in a home visit. In those clinical contexts, and in the context in the hospital or in an assisted living facility or nursing home, if there's a medical record and the notation is made in the medical record, of course, that's the whole point of this, to get the information in the medical record. So in those contexts, we have an exception that none of the provisions of this bill in terms of prescriber notification apply if it's done in those contexts and entered into the medical record in those facilities, because that fulfills the need of getting the information back. And then lastly, I think the only other thing, I'll be glad to answer any questions, or actually there are two other things. One other point is we have updated the definition. We no longer use the term in the bill biosimilar that we used in 2013. We're using the term more specifically like it is used in the federal law, and we're directing the Board of Pharmacy and its rules to define it consistent with the federal law. And you'll see in the bill and in the amendment with some changes in how that is laid out, very specific references to very specific paragraphs of very specific federal law, so we have consistency across the country and consistency with federal law in this regard.
What's the federal term?
The federal term? Well, the federal term is biological product, and then there's a federal definition of when it's interchangeable, which is, means it can be substituted. Right. So the definition of interchangeable is critical that it be the same as the federal definition.
Yeah.
And then lastly, we are once again proposing, because there are developments in electronic medical record systems and in the healthcare system in general, that there is a sunset in 6 years. That is not popular with any number of people. And in fact, I need to tell you, there are a number of these provisions that aren't popular to some one or another group, but it is what we think is necessary to get enough people comfortable, enough people either supporting or neutral to get the bill passed. One other thing I would just point out, a lot of folks who...
That's your third lastly.
So. Oh, no more about the bill, Mr. Chairman.
This I didn't testify, remember.
About the issue. What has happened since 2013 is a number of people who opposed the bill in 2013 have either gone neutral or gone supportive. That includes the Generic Drug Manufacturers, Generic Pharmaceutical Association, a variety of patient groups always supported, a variety of provider groups always supported it, but the Generic Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association opposed it. And a number of the chain drug stores also opposed it, and they are now neutral with these changes as drafted in this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Next.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Luis Rodriguez. I'm the Government Relations Director for the State of Oregon with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I think Paul did a great job of sort of summarizing the issue, summarizing the bill. Before we do that, I do want to thank Representative Nose for all of his work in putting something together that and all of the stakeholders for really taking a look at this issue and coming up with something that most people can live with, as he mentioned. ACS CAN is actually supportive of the bill. It's not just something that we can live with. We're actually quite happy with the result, primarily because of the prescriber communication. So Paul mentioned that these are very complex drugs that are grown in live organisms. And we also deal with a very complex patient population. So we're not just dealing with complex drugs, but we also have patients who are taking a lot of different drugs. They might be taking a lot of different biologics or biosimilars potentially down the road. And we want to make sure that should there be some sort of adverse reaction to the product, that the physician has the necessary information to make that determination most easily. And so that's why we are in favor of the prescriber communication. We're okay with the proposed languages to change the date or the number of days from 5 business days to, or 5 calendar days to 5 business days, and as well as the 6-year sunset provision. I would also like to highlight that ACS CAN also likes to see the patient notification piece in there, which is one perspective that might be a little bit different from the other stakeholders at the table. We do want patients notified whenever this substitution is happening, because again, like the physician, we want the patient to be able to have as much information as possible about his or her care. And so thank you again, and urge your support for this bill.
Good afternoon. Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association. The Oregon Medical Association has, from the beginning of this discussion, supported provider notification, communication when a biosimilar or biologic is substituted. So we continue to support that concept. We're happy to see that it was, again, put in this language. And although there is a sunset, it's long enough in the future to give us some time to see how this all works out. And so we look forward to working on the implementation when we actually have some products to substitute. And we appreciate Representative Nose for all his work on this. It wasn't always easy. It was a big table, and we appreciate your efforts.
Good afternoon. For the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services. This bill we've looked at through both our provider and insurer lens, and we really struggled with this bill. This was, frankly, not our favorite bill. not our favorite issue. It wasn't our favorite in 2013 either, but here we are. We had several things that we were concerned about and shared with the sponsor as well as the proponents, things that if they were resolved, that we could be neutral. And as we look through the Dash 1 amendments, for the most part, we are there. There is one thing that we believe we need to raise for purposes of clarity, and just to get that on the record. The provision regarding patient notification, we believe that this is essential. It's a matter of good pharmacy practice. We counsel our patients on what it is that they're receiving, with generic or biologic or interchangeable biologic when that's possible, or when that becomes available in the future. However, the intent in both 2013 as well as now was that that language replicated the same process as notification for generics. And that was the intention of the language in 2013. It is my understanding that information came back from the Board of Pharmacy signaling that that is not how they necessarily interpret the language that was currently in there. So the Dash 1 amendment makes changes to the current language. It is our hope to get clarity from the Board of Pharmacy on the record that they will view that, again, that the process laid out and the Dash 1 amendment, that language would be the same as they would interpret it the same way as they do the current generics process. We think that that's essential so that we make sure that patients in a consistent way get information about what drugs they received and in the same way so that there isn't an operational difference in how that notification occurs. Because that notification for us as a health system, as Mr. Cosgrove noted, that can happen at the retail pharmacy in the hospital. It can happen at the patient's bedside. It can happen in a clinic in the same way that dispensing of other drugs occurs. So we want to make sure that that's consistent so that there's no chance for error there. We really want to thank the proponents and Representative Nose for enduring our many questions and concerns and for working with us. Providence is really pleased that this bill, as drafted, will not create any impediments to the dispensing of interchangeable biologics, which importantly not only represent opportunities for patients to get treated with high quality drugs, but lower cost, high quality drugs. And that's essential to make sure that folks can afford what are new and life-saving treatments. So thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Mr. Chair. Question?
Yes.
Good. Just real quick, and I'll ask Paul. It may fall to Representative Nose, but Eli Lilly and the other drug companies are all supportive, the way I understand this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I hesitate to always talk about everybody's support. the coalition in support of this includes Eli Lilly. It includes all the drug companies who are represented in the building, with I think maybe one exception, and it includes both Pharma, which is the Association of Innovator drug manufacturers, as well as the generic drug manufacturers. So there may be an exception. No one's here to say that one, but I think I just hesitate to say that it's 100%. But it's nearly everyone.
Great job.
Thank you. Representative Mueller?
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlick. First a comment and then a question. So I share your concerns, Jessica, that I think patients should have easy transparency to these substitutions. Mm-hmm. So my question is, there opposition to the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I think you'll hear from Tom Holt on behalf of Cambia that they still oppose the bill with the Dash 1. There may be others in the health insurance industry who share his views. That is the only opposition of which I'm aware, and we had, and Representative Nose is responsible for this, in a good way. We had a very open table, a very big group of people who were, and we tried to incorporate all the suggestions people could make that we felt met the goals of the bill into the Dash 1. But I think there are some people who were opposed, who remain opposed, and Mr. Holt.
We have four more witnesses.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, Providence is not, again, provided that the Board of Pharmacy views the notification as congruent with the generics. We are neutral with the dash one, and we really appreciate the work to get us there.
Would you call the next panel, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you leave the chairs here with me? We have four more. I have one more panel.
Eric Lintner, Josh Free, Nikki Terziev, and Tom Holt.
Again, please try and be brief. We have one more bill, but I expect several witnesses.
Two pages. Uh-huh. Barnhart's bill has two pages.
Here you go. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. And my name is Eric Lintner. I'm a pharmacist in Oregon. Have been for 30-some-odd years. I guess maybe I'm the only opposition. I don't know. But I'm not in favor of the bill. And I would say that I don't see the benefit to it. I think a lot of work's gone into it, but I don't see the benefit. I think our state has some very specific rules around substitutions that handle this nicely. I think physicians have total authority to say what they want to prescribe up front, and I don't think it requires anything other than that. I don't think it requires an extra system that puts extra work on the pharmacy and the pharmacist and extra cost into the system. I think we're in a position where we're trying to streamline and make more efficient our healthcare system, and I think this goes in the opposite direction. I have another couple of points very briefly. Paul, I believe his name was Cosgrove, mentioned that there was something in the bill that allows for simply submitting a claim to a third-party payer as adequate notice to the physician. I'm not aware how that would work. I don't believe the physicians get back anything from that system that would allow them to see what had happened unless they have some roundabout way of querying it. I'm not familiar with that, and I hope that's not glossing over something that really doesn't exist. And then the last thing is we have expanded the wording from biosimilar out to biologic. And as a pharmacist, that creates a lot of confusion in my mind. I, driving down here, could not think whether or not some particular drugs would fall into that category and whether I would have a requirement for notification. In my mind, that greatly expands my requirements. That makes it onerous, to be frank. And I don't believe the average pharmacist, myself included, has the references to find out how a product was made. You know, I can't go and query each manufacturer and find out how they made the product to find out whether or not it's within the definition of a biologic to know whether I have this requirement for notification. So thank you for your time. That is all I had to mention, unless you have some questions.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Nikki Terziev here again on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition, along with Josh Free. We were a part of this conversation, and with the sunset included in the dash one, have come as an association, as a coalition, to neutral position on the bill. There are, I think, as Mr. Lintner pointed out, a couple of questions outstanding. I will allow Josh to ask after just a couple of them, but I want to make sure, for the record, our position is on neutral, and thank you, Representative Nose, for working with us.
Josh Free, President, Oregon State Pharmacy Association. As Nikki said, our position on this has been neutral. That is not to say we don't have concerns about some of the language. In particular, a couple things I'll point out. There are some wording around nursing facilities and assisted living facilities that's not consistent with other definitions of such facilities that needs some work. In particular, calling out assisted living is not quite specific enough. There's another term, community-based care, that encapsulates other facilities like assisted living. I would agree that the labeling biologic versus biosimilar is highly problematic for us. We're hoping that can be addressed so that we can remain neutral. And just recounting some of the history here, the FDA uses the term biosimilar and interchangeable biosimilar. And as I understand it, in an attempt to get to a generic-like system where certain high-cost biological drugs might be substituted to a lower cost alternative. That's where that biosimilar and interchangeable biosimilar concept came from. To date, we have no interchangeable biosimilars that a pharmacist could substitute. But it seems that sticking with that term, which is the term the FDA uses, would clarify things for the pharmacy profession quite a bit. And then the other piece, it's a little bit of minutia, but there was some language around record-keeping requirements, and I would just like to point out that the Board of Pharmacy already has record-keeping requirements for prescriptions in their regulations, and so it, to me, did not seem necessary to add that or add redundancy or a different record-keeping requirement than what might already be there. So, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Holt.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We're not the only opposition. In fact, we only represent about 700,000 people to whom we provide health benefit services. And part of our role is helping our members get treatment at the lowest possible cost that is effective. The FDA has, over the last several years, developed a very clear process for what is an interchangeable biologic. At a policy level, we object to casting a cloud over this new class of drugs that, while we don't know yet what the cost savings is going to be for equally effective treatments, there is a lot of talk in the trades that we should expect to see something in the range of 25% to 30% savings. It makes no sense to us to cast a cloud over this, make pharmacies keep additional records, do additional things for this new class of drugs. You know, Oregon should not be second-guessing the FDA in this respect. The other objections we have are at a technical level. The amendment still does not clarify whether a pharmacist is going to be obliged to notify an individual in advance of dispensing one of these. Where that's important is, as Mr. Cosgrove himself mentioned, many of these drugs are dispensed or will be dispensed in a specialty pharmacy. That's not a pharmacy typically that one walks into and has an interaction with the pharmacist. These are pharmacies that perform another number of other services. They do follow-ups with patients. It's one of the things we require them to do, coach them about side effects and make sure that people stick with their therapy and things of that nature. But the point is, they're not there in front of them. So if the communication has to be made before dispensing, that means we're slowing down getting the medication to the person, because these are pharmacies that generally are shipping the drugs to a person's home or where they're being treated. They might be in an assisted living or a long-term care facility. So I found it curious that the amendment lists a number of places that people reside rather than the type of pharmacy from which the drug would be dispensed. It's also important, I think, to note that...
I hate to do this, but you really need to speed up. I've got
there,
a ton of witnesses on
Mr.
this.
Chair, I have one more very brief and important
Go
point.
For it,
the
please.
Focus here has been on the notice. I would ask that you look at the fact that the definition is greatly broadening the scope of drugs affected, specifically as a class, insulin. There is going to be an interchangeable biologic to a very expensive brand name insulin coming to the market, we expect, soon. We think the push for these bills has a lot to do with that. So we are opposed. I frankly find it hard to imagine we would get to a place on behalf of the 700,000 people that we serve that we could get to a place where it's okay to cast a cloud over saving money for our members.
Thank you very much. I think you'll have a chance to talk to other members before we work the bill. Thank you all. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4105, open up a work session on House Bill 4105 for the purpose of adding the dash one amendment to the bill. Do I have a motion?
Sure, I'll make one. Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 4105, dated February 2nd, 2016.
Representative Nose moves we adopt the dash one amendments dated February 2nd, 2016. The House Bill 4105. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? So moved. Close the work session on House Bill 4105, and I sense we'll get back to it probably Monday. We will reschedule that. By Friday, we have to schedule everything we're going to do work sessions on. And that'll be a part of Friday. Part of the work we do on Friday. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4062. Okay. We have a hearing. We have a lot of people involved. I'm going to give you 1 minute each so we can get as many of you in. Our purpose on this bill would be to move it to the Revenue Committee for final action. We have to be out of here in 30 minutes, so... I'd like to start by inviting people who have come from 100 miles or further away. I think we have several of them. If you verify you really did come and we call your name, you really did come from 100 miles, that would be great. Would you please?
Jason Weber. Tim Churchill.
Yes, from Medford.
Come on.
Spencer Knowles.
Okay.
Please come up.
The three of you, come on.
Do you want to put, okay. And then I believe TJ Ridley came from 100 miles. We can be, come up when one of them is finished. Thank you. Go.
Please go ahead.
Except at the time.
We'll be letting you know in a minute.
So. I guess I'm starting. Let's do this quickly. My notes are on my phone here, not being rude. My name is Spencer Knowles. I'm from Bend. I'm a vape shop owner, and we've had a shop there for 2 years. We help people quit smoking every day with vaporizing. So we as the vapor industry have helped thousands of smokers release themselves from the grip of tobacco industry. The same goal as a tobacco use reduction account. Our client base, as well as the entire smoking population, at least most of them, is traditionally in the lower income brackets. And this tax will take away a potentially life-saving alternative from them. The 50% tax proposed on vaporizing products, I believe, will price vaporizing products above tobacco itself, which is going to deter people from using vaporizing to quit smoking. So, this bill will cause thousands of children to return to homes with secondhand smoke, where their parents are still smoking. And this will be far more likely to start smoking in children if their parents are still smoking at home, enabling a new generation of tobacco addicts in our youth today. I really do believe that vaporizing with the parents will keep smoking out of the houses and keep children away from secondhand smoke. Just because the Oregon legislature is addicted to the tobacco tax funds doesn't mean you should force the general population of Oregon back into the grip of big tobacco.
Thank you very much. Yes.
My name is Jason Weber. I own Vape Crusaders in Roseburg, Oregon. And I got into this business because I smoked for cigarettes for 14 years, pack a day. Thanks to vaping, I'm now 4 years without tobacco. I feel great. I feel like I never smoked a cigarette before. You know, me and my wife, with the help of our friends and employees, have helped multiple people get the same success, over 400 to be exact. This 50% tax will shut us down. I've been in business for 15 months, and we can't afford it. And exactly like this gentleman said, it's going to send people right back to cigarettes. And if we all shut down, I mean, there's going to be no revenue from the vaping industry in Oregon anyway. So I just urge you to really think about it. The only reason this makes sense is if big tobacco's success makes sense. Otherwise, it's hurting people who are actually trying to benefit and get away from the grip of tobacco. So, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hey, folks, thanks for coming from so far away at this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee. For the record, my name is Tim Churchill. I'm from Medford. I work with EC Blend Company. We actually manufacture the e-liquid that goes in the electronic cigarettes. I spent 26 years earlier in my life when I was younger and energetic in the grocery retail business. And from that experience, anytime you raise the price of a product by 50%, you're going to slow that down. And in a highly competitive market, you'll kill that product. And a lot of these vape shops are very small shops, and the main competition is coming from the internet. There's a huge internet base on that, a lot of it coming from overseas. And my concern is that it will close stores in Oregon, send Oregon dollars out of Oregon, and in fact overseas, and you won't see that tax revenue at all. That's pretty much it. I appreciate what you guys do, and I really urge you not to overregulate this potentially product that could potentially be a harm reduction product.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay. T.J. Ridley?
Somebody here with an attendant?
From 100 miles. I'm in Eugene, so.
Okay.
All right, come
then.
On.
Close.
Let's fill up.
Some would say it's another
two
world.
Two more chairs.
Okay. Joseph Gilpatrick and John Paxson.
Is there somebody here with an attendant that I see on the back?
Excuse me?
Is there a person with an attendant?
I don't know. Please.
Hi, thank you to the committee for hearing us out today. We're all really passionate business owners who are here to fight for our businesses, our investments, our families, and our futures. And I'm the owner of Urban Vapors in Eugene.
Your name?
My name's Timothy Ridley. I just want to talk about House Bill 4062, which proposes a 50% tax on the devices and the e-liquid that fills the devices. My profit margins at my store across the board are 50%. So automatically this shuts my business down. This completely, on day one, I go into the conversation with my employees saying, guys, we have to lay you off. We have to figure out an exit strategy. That's the end. That's why I'm here fighting. I just opened a store, a second location. I have 20 employees. We're very successful because we believe in, family as a crew and helping people get away from, deadly cigarettes. What we've created is a consumer solution to the tobacco problem. And it wasn't being done before. Nicorette, gum, patches, all these things. It's not as successful for smokers. And I think every smoker like me who smoked for 5 years, half a pack to a pack a day can testify that those things don't work. What's that?
Who's wrap up?
Okay. This bill would force me and probably all brick and mortar electronic cigarettes outlets out of business. I'm just here to vote no, and I strongly urge you guys to vote no on House Bill 4062.
Thank you. Okay, Bueller, did you have a question?
I didn't. Just really quick. Did you say you have a 50% margin on your business?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
That's a gross profit margin before expenses.
Okay.
That's just on product.
Yeah. Okay. My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. I'm the owner of Northwest Freedom Vape. I also manufacture e-liquid here in Oregon. I purchased nicotine from the same companies, the patch, the gum, the lozenger, the dissolvable strip, which is also not FDA approved, is also creating all these products to help people quit smoking cigarettes with. I just want to quickly educate you guys on the fact that nicotine doesn't have tar. There's no carcinogens. It's a stimulant, one stimulant, like caffeine. Right. There are many energy drinks across the market that have 15 to 25 stimulants that are very similar to this that are not approved by the FDA and are readily available for any child in any liquor store or any market. These devices are actually not an inhalant delivery system. It's a nicotine delivery system. It's made to inhale and deliver nicotine into the system in place of smoke and carcinogens and tar. A nicotine delivery system is not an inhalant delivery system. A nicotine delivery system is something that has been misused for, say, marijuana, for cannabinoids, for lots of these other products. A cup is not a whiskey delivery system. It's a cup. It's not meant to be taxed. A straw is not a cocaine delivery system. It's a straw being misused, or a dollar bill, for instance. We need to look at what we're taxing here without representation. This is, in my opinion, appalling, and it's very offensive that our government is even considering taxing something like this, because it is a life-saving device. And if you say that there are deadly chemicals, I urge you to name two. Thank you very much for your time.
My name is John Baxson, for the record. I come before you, Mr. Chair, and the committee to kind of just go on that there's a tax on tobacco because it's unhealthy. You know, there's a tax on liquor because it's unhealthy. This isn't proven to be, you know, very, very unhealthy. I mean, actually, there's studies proving that it's much healthier. So with that being said, why put a tax on something that isn't proven to be as dangerous, nowhere near as dangerous as tobacco, which is, you know, our main competitor with this. And with this tax hike, I wouldn't go back to cigarettes. The tobacco industry would just simply lose out on somebody. You know, my tax dollars would not go towards any of these sin taxes. I would just simply up and stop. So I urge you all to vote no on this.
Thank you very much. Okay. You have the next panel, please.
I do. Jen Baker, Jennifer Vines, Courtney Dresser.
Mr. Chair? Just going through, because look, I was just going through this with the vape pens and stuff, checking Amazon, and a lot of the products you can buy off Amazon. So which I use Amazon Prime. If you were to purchase it here, you wouldn't be taxed, but if I went into a vape shop, I would be taxed with this bill. So essentially, these guys would lose all the business and people would go to Amazon to buy the product.
Please.
Go. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker, here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. ONA is proud to be part of a broad public health coalition supporting House Bill 4062. Working with the coalition of local health officials, the Public Health Association, the Association of Oregon Counties, OHSU, Providence, Oregon School-Based Health Alliance, and many others, we're urging you to pass House Bill 4062 to implement a tax on e-cigarettes here in Oregon. Last legislative session, you took an important first step to regulate these products. The World Health Organization recommends that electronic cigarettes be regulated in line with traditional tobacco products. Last session, we prohibited the sale to minors and included these products in the Indoor Clean Air Act. Other recommendations include FDA oversight. It would be challenging to name two chemicals that are in these products because there's no FDA regulation and there's no way to tell what is in any given product. The World Health Organization also suggests the ban of flavors, ban of advertisement restrictions, prohibiting the use of health benefits or cessation claims, and increasing the price high enough for so that kids cannot afford it. So the goal of this this legislation would be to pass the price increase along to the consumer, especially young Oregonians who are incredibly price sensitive. I do have written testimony that outlines the negative health impacts of nicotine and these products that I will leave for you on Oatless. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Good afternoon once again. Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and we too are here to support House Bill 4062 and all the reasons that our colleagues from the Oregon Nurse Association just outlined. I wanted to just highlight a recent study done by some pediatricians for an article in JAMA, and in particular talking about the rise of teens using these inhalers inhalant delivery products and e-cigarettes, and then that what happens as they age and they progress into using tobacco products. So for adults, it might be helpful to have these products available to them to help them stop smoking cigarettes, but for on the teen side, it's actually leading them to smoking tobacco products later in life, and some of the early studies we're looking at. So again, we're looking at price sensitivity issues, and we're hoping if raising this price will allow them to allow the youth and teens not to get these products. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jennifer Vines. I'm the Deputy Health Officer from Multnomah County Health Department. I'm a family doctor, and I'm board certified in preventive medicine. I'll be brief, but I'll just start by emphasizing that in support of House Bill 4062, this bill will almost certainly protect many of Oregon's young people from the harms of nicotine and very likely head off a lifetime of struggle with addiction to nicotine and other health problems. We know from our experience with tobacco that the more expensive the product is, the fewer kids try it and become hooked. Increasing the price of tobacco is considered a public health best practice, and it makes perfect sense to me as a public health physician to apply this logic to electronic cigarettes and inhalant delivery systems. I testified to a year ago, and I'll remind you of the science around the adolescent brain, which is still developing. Animal models suggest that exposure to nicotine results in long-term physical changes in the brains of young people related to learning and intellect. Other studies show an association between youth nicotine use and behavioral problems later in life, like depression, anxiety, and other substance abuse. The Multnomah County Board of County Commissioners has recognized the urgent public health issue of unregulated electronic cigarettes. Last year, our board passed ordinances intended to reduce youth access to these products, as you did, and is incorporating inhalant delivery systems into our local tobacco retail licensing ordinance. Addressing tobacco and nicotine addiction remains a top public health priority. Dedicating a portion of House Bill 4062's tax to the tobacco use reduction account would help support interventions across the state that prevent youth nicotine addiction and support adults who want to quit. In short, House Bill 4062 is a win for public health. Thank you for the chance to testify.
Thank you very much. Thank you, guys. Can you call another panel, please?
Okay. Carrie Nissen, Elizabeth Kushbaugh, and Wendy Johnson, and if we can, Mike, if you want to scoot up a chair, the four of you can come up at the same time. Or you can wait until somebody steps away and we can do it.
Whichever is the fastest.
Yeah.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Kushbaugh, I'm the strategic director with Children First for Oregon, and we advocate for policies and programs that help keep kids healthy and safe. To that end, we are in support of House Bill 4062. Give you a couple of very quick facts. E-cigarette usage among high school students has tripled in Oregon in the last 3 years. We know that high school kids who used e-cigarettes were almost twice as likely to begin smoking as non-users of e-cigarettes were, and that nearly 9 out of every 10 smokers began smoking before they were 18. So, given that studies show that youth are 2 to 3 times more price responsive than the general population, it only makes sense that imposing a tax on e-cigarettes will help to dissuade kids from becoming addicted to nicotine. Additionally, it is included in the 2016 Children's Agenda published by United for Kids. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Burdick. I'm legislative assistant to Representative Barnhart, who introduced this bill. He introduced the bill because he believes electronic cigarettes should be subject to a tax in the state of Oregon. And thank you very much for hearing the bill today. Representative Barnhart wants more tax revenue in order to help support education and other state services, and this could be a source for that. In addition, as Elizabeth said, the price increase has been shown to significantly reduce rates of new addiction. But chiefly, Rep. Barnhart asked me to call your attention to the fact that this bill has been given a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, and he asked me to assure you that issues related to revenue will be thoroughly evaluated by the Revenue Committee, such as the rate of the tax, how to administer the tax. If this committee chooses to move the bill forward, the Revenue Committee will take a look at those issues.
Okay.
I got to say, I'm impressed with how Absolutely. You can compress a testimony into 1 minute. It's pretty good.
I can do that again.
I will try to match that. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I'm with the American Lung Association in Oregon. Today, the American Lung Association released our 14th annual State of Tobacco Control Report. And this report shows the progress or not that states and the federal government are making to reduce tobacco use. The report shows that there's clearly more that we can do in our state and around our nation to protect our youth, families, and communities from tobacco use. This report highlights that 1 in 4 youth in our nation are still using tobacco. While youth cigarette smoking is declining, youth e-cigarette use and hookah use are increasing at alarming rates. Our kids are still getting addicted to nicotine. The vast majority of current smokers who use e-cigarettes still also use combustible cigarettes, about 76.8% in 2012-2013. The American Lung Association strongly supports taxing e-cigarettes at a rate equivalent with all tobacco products to help deter our youth from using these nicotine delivery devices. We strongly support the provision for a portion of the revenue to go to tobacco prevention so we can begin to educate our youth and our parents and our communities about the harms of e-cigarettes.
You almost made it. Not bad.
A little bit over?
Not much.
Mr. Chair, okay.
I'm having troubles because okay. Isn't it illegal for us to sell these to children under the age of 18?
Yes.
Didn't we just pass that law?
Yes.
So it would be illegal if any one of these businesses did that, but they can go online, because I just pulled up cigarettes, everything.
I'd like to hear some more testimony about people.
Well, these are people that are very involved with this.
No, I want to bring them up so they have a chance to talk.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. Matt Minahan, Sid Powers, thanks. James Cook.
I was still with the last.
Oh, yes. Sorry. So just two of you then. Matt Minahan, Sid Powers. And then we'll go.
Go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I handle tax and revenue issues, and as Michael Burdick explained, should this bill pass out of the committee, it would go to revenue, so some of the issues that I will be quickly hitting would be addressed, hopefully more there.
Where would be addressed?
In House Bill 2546 that was just mentioned that passed last session, the legislature decided that, you know, made some of the policy decisions on the health benefits or the problems with this. And when you did that, you also added more crimes affecting minors, and then you also added it to the Clean Air Act, Oregon's Indoor Clean Air Act. And as cities, we have to regulate and enforce those provisions. Our problem with the bill right now is the distribution is on the last page. Section 14, it only distributes the tax revenues to the tobacco use reduction account and the general fund. So cities would get no share of this tax on the vaping products. And so that's our concern with the bill. Right now, cigarette taxes, we get 2%, cities do. It used to be more than 50% that cities got from cigarette tax, and the legislature has continually taken that share away. Cigarette tax revenues have also gone down exponentially in years, which is a positive thing, but basically we're getting no money now to take care of the enforcement of these regulations. And so we would be seeking an amendment to change how the distribution goes. Thank you.
Chair Green, like members of the committee, I'm going to be under 1 minute. My name is Matt Minahan. I represent the Northwest Vapor Association. We're here in opposition to the bill today. We think it's too excessive. The industry is too young to handle that. We would be very happy to sit down and have some real discussions around some reasonable tax bills that will be more reasonable and maybe include some preemptions. Close your ears. preemptions from so the local preemptions. We would be happy to have those discussions. And then Representative Weiner, you were very correct. And we take actually one step further and not selling to minors. Most of our members, if not all, do not allow 17 and under in the stores whatsoever, not even allowed in the front door. So I'll be available for questions if you have any, and I hope I was under my 1 minute.
Ooh. Yeah.
Promise.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sidney Powers III. I moved here from Amarillo, Texas approximately 5 months ago. This beautiful, simple device was given to me by my children who run Northwest Freedom Vape in Lebanon, Oregon. Within 3 weeks, I had totally lost my dry hacking cough. I got off of a 41-year chewing tobacco habit. Within 6 weeks, the calloused patches on my gums and cheeks had dissolved completely. As a youth, I started out smoking. My wife and I both quit when our children started coming along because we wanted to raise them healthy. But the 41-year chewing tobacco habit, it didn't affect anybody. Nobody could even tell that I was doing it. Children, young children, are going to sneak cigarettes from their parents who go back to smoking or using tobacco products. It's a given. If you want to keep children from using tobacco products, you need to support the vaping industry and not keep putting these horrendous bills on them. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Who we got?
Quinn has a question.
Yes.
Quick question?
Would you call? Oh, yes. For this panel? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Vape Association. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I have one quick question. I am a healthcare provider and a very strong advocate for good healthcare, but what I'm not seeing anybody addressing here, and I'm asking the question, has the Vape Association or the Nursing Association done any studies on a tax that is double recreational marijuana?
Yes.
Would that drive people, youth that we're concerned with, to use more recreational marijuana? Or have there been any studies that look at if we tax at twice the rate of recreational marijuana for this product, would it affect the consumer?
An opportunity to.
And I'm asking because I haven't seen that addressed.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm not sure I'm the best one for that question.
That's where I work.
We're not really tied into the. I'm not aware of any studies.
I think
no.
She wants you to call.
We're not tied into the marijuana. You know, we're completely separate from marijuana, so we don't track that as much. What that would do, I don't know if I can answer that question. I know there are no studies. I do know that if you tax the vaping industry, what our concern about is it's going to stop the flow from smoking, you know, quitting smoking to vaping. I don't know if I can answer your question what that would do. We like to think it's completely separate from marijuana. If you take one thing away, we're not marijuana, we're vaping.
Mr. Chair, if I could, a quick question.
Sure.
As I recall our testimony on the previous House bill, there was concern that the ingestion of nicotine was also harmful. But I don't recall it clearly, and I guess that's what I'm... It seems to me there's a health hazard here.
Excuse me, sir. It's in every root-bearing vegetable on the planet Earth. It's actually a naturally occurring substance that's in every root-bearing vegetable. Contact?
That's good. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. And one more panel?
No, we're done.
I don't want to get them in. It'd be great to have everybody have a chance to talk.
James Cook, Kelly Lovelace, James Wright, and Justin Rainey. So that's the last four. What's your name? Oh. Yes.
Let's go.
Mr. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Kelly Lovelace. I am an investor in a shop in Eugene. When I looked into this and started to work with it, I was fascinated. You know, you can quit smoking. And every bit of research I could did on it said that it's nowhere near as harmful as cigarettes are. Just period. It's not. I mean, you can find lots of details. It's not like smoking cigarettes. And by the way, they were talking about the cost of cigarettes. I started in 1964. You bought cigarettes for 20 cents a pack in the machine. They're $6 now, and kids are still buying them. So I'm not sure that you're going to stop this thing with raising the prices. A certain amount of kids are going to smoke cigarettes. It's, you know, they're going to be who they are. And so someday they're going to want to quit, just like the rest of us did. But, you know, I think you're kind of talking about a war that we've been fighting for my lifetime, and we're not winning it yet. So let's offer them something that is not anywhere near as harmful to them and make it work that way. I am against this tax. This tax is outrageous, and it's going to put a lot of these shops out of business, and it's going to cost a lot of investors to lose quite a bit of money. And I'm not happy about that. I'm honest about it. I'm not happy that...
Please wrap it up.
Okay, well, that's what I have to say. I think you're doing something that should not be done at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is James Cook, and I don't have a notebook or an iPad, and I'm not a very eloquent speaker.
You do.
I'm a third-generation Oregonian, and I'm just going to say what's on my mind. 50%, that's half. Half. That's crazy. That's a crazy tax. These products saved my life, my grandchildren. I have four of them now. I'm going to be able to hang around with them, you know, and go to Cub Scouts and do those types of things. But my question is this, is on a bigger scale, and I'll try to wrap it up quickly, is, you know, we're looking for a tax. Where does this number come from? If it's 50%, that's outrageous for a tax. And I hear about marijuana being at 25%. Why not make it 1,000%, you know, if we want to make some money? It doesn't make any sense to me. I think it's outrageous, and that's my the opinion that I would like to voice. This is potentially life-saving technology. It was for me, and that's anecdotal evidence. That's what my doctor tells me, and I'm grateful for it. Please don't kill it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of Reynolds American. Reynolds American is the second largest manufacturer of cigarettes. We also manufacture the product Vuse. We're concerned with the 50% sales tax on the product for a lot of the reasons you've heard. We believe this would price a less harmful product off the market. Majority of people who currently smoke make under $25,000 a year. So increasing this would give them no reason to switch. For the committee's review, I've provided several different studies that submitted as written testimony. The first is a resolution and white paper from the American Association of Public Health Physicians that talks about e-cigarettes and tobacco harm reduction. The second is a study from University College of London talking about using e-cigarettes as a smoking cessation device. And the last is an article by Scott Moody, Chief Executive Officer and Economist of State Budget Solutions, entitled E-Cigarettes Are Poised to Save Medicaid Billions. Studies show promise in using e-cigarettes as a method to help smokers quit. They show the use that this is a less harmful product than traditional cigarettes, and they also talk about potential cost savings for government programs. I'll wrap up my comments with that since we're just talking about some of the health impacts, but we also have concerns with how the tax would be administered at the retail level. We think it should be done at the wholesale level, similar to cigarette taxes if you go down this path, and the rate we believe should be compared to the relative risks and harms associated with the product. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you get one more, is that right? Mm-hmm. Come on, take a chair. You guys hang in. We're going to have a motion as soon as we're done.
Oh. For the record, my name is James Wright, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I am also in opposition of the tax bill for many of the reasons presented. And also, I would like to note that the World Health Organization, since it was brought up, has also done a study saying bacon causes cancer. So there's that also. So, but the 50% tax, I run a very small shop. It is family-owned. It is me, my wife, and my father-in-law. This tax would kill that shop. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming to testify. It's very important to us to hear whether you're in favor or opposed to a bill to get the testimony. It is important. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4062 and open a work session.
Oh, sorry, sir.
On House Bill 4062.
You have a note.
I have a note.
Yes, from Kenny Dyer. From the Standardese.
Standardese. Yes.
Yep.
4062, and we are adjourned. I want to thank the committee for your patience.
Yeah.